Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So last year, one of the major political developments was the issuing of an arrest warrant by, I'm always confused, was it Interpol or ICC? Or does the ICC issue an arrest warrant that decree it that Interpol issues it? I'm not sure on the mechanics. I'm sure you guys can clarify for me and our listeners exactly how that works. But in any event, for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and I believe a couple of other generals involved in the war in Gaza, this was a pretty big deal because, Netanyahu remains the Prime Minister of Israel. And it's been taken seriously enough that according to the anorak who track flights on the internet, the Prime Minister has routed his flight path to the US over to avoid flying over the airspace of countries that have said that they would enforce the warrant and arrest him if he were to land. So my question, Herman and Corin, is this concept of, I guess, international police and international justice. To me, that seems hard to understand how, if Interpol issues this and this is a done thing, why is it that there's debate among countries as to whether they would or wouldn't, take action by having their police force arrest the Prime Minister and incarcerate him. Whether that would happen or not, I guess, is kind of a moot point, because it's, catastrophically unlikely that the plane would be diverted into, especially when they're taking precautions. But how does that work exactly? This question of when Interpol, they don't typically get involved in issuing warrants for, minor crimes. Individuals who've committed minor crimes, let's say, in their country. It seems to always be a high-profile case. So how does that process work exactly, and why is there some ambiguity as to whether a country will honour it or not? Do they have to be a member of some treaty? How does it work exactly? Herman and Corin, would love your clarification on this contentious but important matter.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corn, and I am joined as always by my brother.
Herman Poppleberry, reporting for duty. It is good to be here, Corn. We have got a lot to chew on today.
We really do. This one hits a bit close to home, literally, since we are sitting here in our house in Jerusalem. Our housemate Daniel sent us a voice note about something that has been a persistent cloud over the local and international news cycles for over a year now. He's curious about the mechanics behind international arrest warrants, specifically the ones issued by the International Criminal Court for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other officials back in late 2024.
It is a great question because there is so much terminology thrown around in the news. You hear International Criminal Court, or ICC, and then you hear Interpol, and people often conflate the two or assume they are the same thing. They are very much not. Daniel was asking about who actually issues these, how the process works, and why there is so much debate about whether countries will actually enforce them.
Right. And that ambiguity is the part that really trips people up. If it is an arrest warrant, why is it optional for some and mandatory for others? We are going to dig into the legal architecture of this today. Herman, you have been digging into the Rome Statute and the procedural history of these warrants. Where should we start?
I think we have to start by clarifying the roles of the players involved. Let us talk about the International Criminal Court versus Interpol. Most people think of Interpol as a sort of global police force, like in the movies where agents from different countries team up to chase a villain across borders. In reality, Interpol is more like a massive, high-tech bulletin board. It is a coordination body. They do not have their own officers who can go out and kick down doors and make arrests.
Exactly. They facilitate information sharing between national police forces. So, when people ask if Interpol issues warrants, the answer is technically no. They issue what are called red notices. A red notice is an electronic alert sent to all 196 member countries saying, hey, this person is wanted for prosecution or to serve a sentence in a specific country or by an international tribunal. It is a request to locate and provisionally arrest that person pending extradition.
Right. Now the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is a completely different animal. It is a permanent international court based in The Hague. Its job is to prosecute individuals for the most serious crimes of concern to the international community. We are talking about genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the crime of aggression.
And that is a crucial distinction. The ICC is a judicial body. When the ICC issues an arrest warrant, it is a legal document signed by judges after a prosecutor presents evidence. In the case Daniel mentioned, the ICC prosecutor, Karim Khan, applied for these warrants in May of 2024. After months of deliberation, the pretrial chamber issued them on November 21st, 2024, citing reasonable grounds to believe crimes like starvation as a method of warfare and crimes against humanity had been committed.
And this is where the friction begins, because, just like Interpol, the ICC does not have its own police force. It cannot send a squad of ICC marshals into a sovereign country to arrest a head of state. It relies entirely on the cooperation of its member states to carry out those arrests.
This brings us to the Rome Statute. That is the treaty that created the ICC. As of right now, there are 124 countries that are parties to the Rome Statute. If you are a member, you have a legal obligation under Article 89 to comply with requests for arrest and surrender.
But, and this is a massive but, not every country is a member. The United States is not a member. China is not a member. Russia is not a member. And, crucially for this discussion, Israel is not a member.
So, if the country where the person is located is not a member of the ICC, the court has no direct leverage to force an arrest within those borders. But the warrant still has teeth once that person travels. That is why we saw reports of the Prime Minister's travel plans being scrutinized for any potential stops in Europe or other member states.
That is a fascinating detail, Korn. It really highlights the practical reality of these legal maneuvers. If you are a leader with an ICC warrant over your head, your world suddenly becomes a lot smaller. You have to look at a map of the 124 member states and realize that if you land in any of them, they are technically required by international law to detain you.
But even within those member states, we see a lot of political maneuvering. Some countries, like the Netherlands or France, have historically affirmed their commitment to the court. Others, like Hungary, have suggested they might not honor specific warrants. Herman, how can a country that signed the treaty just say no? Is there a legal loophole they are using?
There is a lot of legal debate around Article 98 of the Rome Statute. This is one of those technical nuances that the general public rarely hears about, but it is where the real battle happens. Article 98 basically says that the court cannot ask a country to act in a way that would force them to breach their other international obligations regarding diplomatic immunity.
So the argument is that a sitting head of state has sovereign immunity, and if a country arrests them, they are violating that immunity, which might be protected under a different treaty or customary international law.
Exactly. It is a conflict of laws. On one hand, you have the Rome Statute saying you must arrest this person. On the other hand, you have the principle of head of state immunity, which has been a cornerstone of international relations for centuries. The ICC's position is that immunity does not apply when it comes to the specific crimes they prosecute. They point to Article 27, which says that official capacity as a head of state or government shall in no case exempt a person from criminal responsibility.
So you have Article 27 saying immunity does not count, and Article 98 saying the court cannot make you break other immunity rules. It is a built-in tension in the treaty itself.
It really is, and we have seen this play out before. Remember the case of Omar al-Bashir, the former president of Sudan? He had ICC warrants out for him for years. He traveled to several ICC member states like South Africa and Jordan, and they did not arrest him. More recently, in September 2024, Vladimir Putin traveled to Mongolia, which is an ICC member, and they did not arrest him despite the warrant issued for him in 2023. The ICC can rule that these countries failed in their obligations, but there is not really a global police force to punish a country for not cooperating.
And if the UN Security Council is divided, which it almost always is on these high-profile cases, then nothing really happens in terms of enforcement against the country that failed to arrest. It becomes a diplomatic stain rather than a legal catastrophe for that nation.
That is the pragmatic view, certainly. But it is important not to understate the impact. Even if an arrest does not happen immediately, the warrant acts as a permanent brand. It complicates every diplomatic meeting, every trade deal, and every international summit. It shifts the person from being a respected world leader to a fugitive in the eyes of a large portion of the international legal community.
Let us go back to the mechanics for a second. Daniel asked if the ICC or Interpol issues the warrants. We established the ICC issues the judicial warrant. But then, does the ICC go to Interpol and ask for a red notice?
They can. The ICC has a cooperation agreement with Interpol. Once a warrant is issued by the ICC, they can request that Interpol publish a red notice. This ensures that if the individual tries to cross a border anywhere in the world, the border agents will see that alert in their system. It effectively turns every border crossing into a potential trap.
So, it is a two-step process. The ICC provides the legal authority, and Interpol provides the global notification infrastructure. Now, what about the countries that are not members? We mentioned the United States. The U.S. has a very complex relationship with the ICC. They actually passed a law in 2002, the American Service Members Protection Act, often nicknamed the Hague Invasion Act. It theoretically authorizes the use of military force to liberate any American or citizen of a U.S. allied country being held by the ICC.
Right. It is a very strong statement of non-cooperation. And yet, the U.S. has also helped the ICC in the past, for example, by handing over suspects from conflicts in Africa where the U.S. interests aligned with the prosecution. So, it is very selective.
That selectivity is what leads to the charges of double standards that we hear so much about. When the ICC issued a warrant for Vladimir Putin, many Western nations cheered it as a triumph of international justice. But when the prosecutor applied for warrants for Israeli leaders alongside Hamas leaders, many of those same nations were suddenly very critical of the court's jurisdiction.
It is a classic example of the tension between law and geopolitics. The ICC tries to operate as a pure legal institution, but it exists in a world governed by power. One thing that is interesting in the Netanyahu case is the principle of complementarity. This is a core part of the ICC's mandate.
Explain that, because I think that is a key piece of why Israel argues the ICC should not have intervened.
Right. Complementarity means the ICC is a court of last resort. It only steps in if a national legal system is unwilling or unable to genuinely carry out the investigation or prosecution itself. Israel has a very robust and independent judiciary. They argue that because they have their own systems for investigating military conduct, the ICC has no business getting involved.
But the ICC prosecutor's argument is that those domestic investigations have not been sufficient or are not targeting the specific high-level policy decisions that the ICC is looking at. It is a disagreement over whether the domestic system is actually doing the job.
And that is a subjective call in many ways. Who gets to decide if a country's internal investigation is genuine? The ICC judges do. So, the court is essentially grading the homework of a sovereign nation's judiciary. You can see why that creates massive friction.
It is also worth noting that the ICC's jurisdiction in this specific case comes from the fact that Palestine was admitted as a member state of the Rome Statute in 2015. Even though Israel is not a member, the court claims jurisdiction over crimes committed on the territory of a member state. This is the same logic they used for the warrant against Putin. Russia is not a member. But Ukraine accepted the court's jurisdiction over crimes committed on its territory.
Exactly. It is a way for the court to reach citizens of non-member states. If you go into someone else's house and that person is a member of the club, you are subject to the club's rules while you are there. That is the ICC stance. But non-member states like the US and Israel reject this, saying it violates the basic principle of treaty law that a treaty cannot impose obligations on a country that has not signed it.
So we have this massive legal standoff. You have the ICC asserting global reach through territorial jurisdiction, and you have major powers asserting sovereign immunity and the priority of national courts. In the middle of all this, you have the actual mechanics of the warrant. If a red notice goes out, and let us say a leader with a warrant travels to a country that is a member of the ICC, what actually happens at the airport?
Well, in theory, the moment their passport is scanned, the Interpol system flags it. The local police are notified. They are then legally obligated under their own domestic laws that implemented the Rome Statute to take the person into custody. They would then hold a hearing to verify the identity and the validity of the warrant, and then they would arrange for the person to be flown to The Hague to stand trial.
But in practice, if it is a head of state, they are usually traveling with a large security detail and on a private or government plane. They are not standing in the regular customs line at Heathrow or Charles de Gaulle. Their arrival is coordinated weeks in advance. If a country intends to arrest them, they would likely tell the leader not to come in the first place.
Right. It becomes a game of diplomatic shadowboxing. The host country says, "We would love to have you for the summit, but our laws would require us to arrest you, so maybe it is better if you send your foreign minister instead." This happened with Putin and the BRICS summit in South Africa. South Africa is an ICC member. There was a lot of pressure on them to arrest Putin if he showed up. In the end, he just didn't go. He participated via video link.
So the warrant effectively creates a zone of exclusion. It might not lead to an arrest, but it leads to isolation. For a leader like Netanyahu, who has historically prided himself on his international standing, that isolation is a significant political blow.
It really is. And it affects the entire government. If the prime minister cannot travel to certain countries, it limits where the state can conduct high-level diplomacy. It also affects the military. If warrants are issued for generals or defense ministers, they also become restricted in their movements.
I want to touch on something Daniel mentioned about the ambiguity of enforcement. He asked if countries have to be members of a specific treaty to be obligated to honor the warrant. We talked about the Rome Statute, but is there any other way a country could be forced to comply?
Yes, there is one other major mechanism, a United Nations Security Council referral. Under the Rome Statute, the Security Council can refer a situation to the ICC even if the countries involved are not members. This is what happened with Darfur in Sudan and with Libya. When the Security Council makes a referral under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, it creates a legal obligation for all UN member states to cooperate, regardless of whether they signed the Rome Statute.
But that is extremely rare because of the veto power. In the case of Israel or the US, a Security Council referral is essentially impossible because the US would veto it. In the case of Russia, Russia would veto it. So, for these high-profile cases involving major powers or their allies, the court is usually relying on its own territorial jurisdiction rather than a Security Council mandate.
Which brings us back to that 124-member list. That is the list that matters. If you are on that list, you are in a difficult position. You have to choose between your legal obligations to the court and your political relationship with the country whose leader is being targeted.
It is a real test for the international legal order. Some people argue that if the ICC cannot enforce these warrants against powerful leaders, it proves the court is useless. Others argue that the mere fact that the warrants were issued shows that no one is above the law, even if the enforcement is slow and complicated.
I think there is a middle ground. The ICC is a long-term project. It is only about 24 years old. In the grand scheme of legal history, that is a blink of an eye. The goal is to slowly build a norm where international crimes have consequences. Even if the arrest does not happen today, the record is there. The evidence is gathered, the testimony is preserved.
And the political landscape can change. A leader who is in power today and protected by sovereign immunity might not be in power 10 years from now. Once they are out of office, that immunity often evaporates, and the warrant is still waiting. We saw this with Slobodan Milosevic and Charles Taylor. It took years, but they eventually ended up in front of a tribunal.
That is a great point. The law is patient. It does not have an expiration date in the same way a political term does. But I also think we need to look at the second-order effects. What does this do to the prospect of peace negotiations? If a leader knows they are going to be arrested the moment they step down or sign a deal, does that make them more likely to cling to power at any cost?
That is the peace versus justice debate. It is one of the most difficult questions in international relations. If you offer an exit ramp to a leader accused of crimes, you might save lives by ending a war sooner. But you are also sacrificing justice for the victims. The ICC is firmly on the side of justice, but the world's diplomats often have to prioritize peace.
It is a heavy burden for everyone involved. I think for our listeners, the key takeaway is that an international arrest warrant is not a magic wand. It is a legal tool that relies on a very complex web of treaties, domestic laws, and political will.
Right. To summarize for Daniel, the ICC issues the judicial warrant. Interpol can then broadcast that warrant through a red notice to facilitate coordination. The obligation to arrest depends on whether a country has signed the Rome Statute or if there is a UN Security Council mandate. And the ambiguity comes from the clash between those treaty obligations and the traditional rules of diplomatic immunity.
Spot on. And for those living here in Jerusalem or anywhere else affected by these decisions, it is a reminder that the lines on the map are not just borders between countries. They are borders between different legal realities.
It really makes you think about the future of global governance. Are we moving toward a world where a single court in the Netherlands can truly hold anyone accountable? Or are we seeing a retreat back into sovereign blocs where the powerful can shield themselves from international law?
I suspect we will be debating that for the next 50 years. But in the meantime, these warrants are a massive disruption to the status quo. They force every country to pick a side, and they make the world a lot smaller for those named in them.
It is a lot to process. We have covered the legal mechanics, the political friction, and the historical context. I think we have given Daniel a pretty good foundation to understand what is happening when he sees these headlines.
I hope so. It is a fascinating, if somewhat grim, topic, but understanding the plumbing of international justice is the only way to make sense of the news.
Absolutely. Well, I think that is a good place to wrap up our deep dive for today. This has been a really enlightening discussion, Herman. I always appreciate your ability to parse the fine print of these treaties.
Anytime, Korn. It is what I do. I have probably been boring you with the Rome Statute since we were kids.
Guilty as charged. But hey, it comes in handy. Before we sign off, I want to remind everyone that if you are enjoying these deep dives, please leave us a review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It really does help other people find the show, and we love reading your feedback.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. And if you have a topic you want us to explore, or if you just want to get in touch, you can find the contact form and our full archive of over 600 episodes at myweirdprompts.com. We have covered everything from the physics of black holes to the history of the spice trade, so there is plenty to explore.
Thanks again to Daniel for sending this in. We always appreciate the prompts that get us thinking about what is happening right outside our window.
Definitely. Stay curious, everyone.
This has been My Weird Prompts. We will be back next time with another deep dive into whatever is on your mind.
Until then, take care.
Goodbye, everyone.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.